Hello everyone, we've sorted out the remaining hardware and software issues, so let's slowly get started. So hello, my name is Andreas Färber. Most of you know me from talking about ARM boards and hardware enablement at previous events. Today I'm going to talk about a slightly different topic, but I am going to get back to ARM in the end of this presentation. I work at SUSE Labs as a project manager responsible for all our products on the ARM architecture. The topic of today's talk is LoRa and frequency shift keying radio technologies inside the Linux kernel. In particular, how I've been developing such a new kernel technology, and in general, how to use not just ARM boards, but like anything really connected to such ARM boards. At last year's event, and possibly before that, I've been speaking about the three dimensions that we've been working on. So for one, ARM from time to time has been adding new CPU cores, other vendors obviously as well. Then for a given CPU core, there may be one or more companies actually implementing physical chips with that. So that is kind of a one-to-N relationship between the cores to the SoCs. And then finally, for a given chip that people can actually buy through their distributors or from the companies directly, there will be any number of boards with varying number of connectors, additional chipsets on there, and expansion possibilities. Now that is the scope that we have been previously working on, and we were usually pretty happy once we actually had the board booting up into OpenSUSE Tumbleweed and have a prompt and have all the packages in place to be able to reproduce that. But at that point, well, it's slightly boring because you have a Tumbleweed system as you have pretty much anywhere else. So the real value actually comes when you make use of the interfaces that those boards are offering that you would normally not have on, you know, any random notebook or other devices that you may be familiar with. Now, the big question is, the hardware has been out there for you to purchase for quite a long time. How do we actually use this in OpenSUSE? I will be diving first into this generally and then going specifically into those radio chipsets. In general, there are two different types of how the hardware represents itself to the Linux kernel. One is ACPI, as we have on all Intel machines virtually. The other one is the so-called device tree, which is a tree hierarchical representation of data that is then read by the kernel in order to make decisions about what drivers to load and what specific settings to apply. The so-called DTB, those device trees get compiled into a so-called device tree blob, that is in short the DTB, and a device tree overlay is then like a diff that you apply to this base set of information on top in order to customize it to your needs. Now, on the Raspberry Pi, this is fairly easy and kind of well documented in that there is a text configuration file. On OpenSUSE, this will be extraconfig.txt, because config.txt is provided by our packages and may actually get changed on updates of the packages provided by OpenSUSE. In those text config files, you can add a line called dtoverlay and then specify the file name of the overlay that you actually wanted to apply on top of the overlay that it, on top of the device tree that it will be using in the first place. I've run into a slightly odd limitation that nothing will warn about, so if something goes wrong there, there's no error, it will still boot, it will just not have those settings applied. The file name needs to be sufficiently short so that with this prefix notation or any parameters that you may want to add at the end of the line, it is not longer than about 80 characters. once all those things are applied, so either you can write it directly onto the SD card if you already have a Tumbleweed system booting on that system, you can edit that within the system, then you need to reboot in order for them to take effect, and you will see in the proc device tree file system whether the properties have changed in the way that you have told it to, and obviously check whether the drivers have been loaded by the kernel. That is one way that unfortunately is specific to that family of boards. Now, even on the Raspberry Pi, we are using the U-boot bootloader as a second stage bootloader, or third stage, depending on how you count. By default, there is a so-called distribute mechanism that will iterate over the available boot devices, check for what files are available on those boot devices in that particular order, and then normally, because we have the EFI-enabled grub bootloader on our media, it will load grub. However, this can be preempted by having a boot.scr file on there. That's a text script file converted with a binary header. That contains command that would then be executed either before or instead of the commands that it would do by default. So that is one possibility to simply duplicate the relevant commands that you need for booting, that is in particular loading the kernel, loading the device tree, loading the initrd, and then specifying a command to start executing it. And then, before actually executing it, you can, in that script, insert additional commands that it would not execute by default. So for one, normally we would just be passing a variable containing an address to the boot command. For 64-bit ARM, that would be the boot I command. For 32-bit ARM, usually the boot Z command. In this case, if we want to actually mess with that device tree, we need to first tell it what the address of the device tree is before actually booting. That is the fdtadder command as an address. And then afterwards, we can do any things with further fdt commands. In particular, we can load additional DTBO files into memory and then apply them to the base DTB file with this fdt apply command down there. So one thing to be aware of is that the behavior is vastly different from the Raspberry Pi in that if anything goes wrong, like if the syntax is wrong or it doesn't find what you actually want to do there, this will break and the base device tree will be in an unusable shape. So you'll need to start from scratch or reboot whatever you're doing in your particular setup. Once the script has been compiled and is in place, you can simply reboot the board and those settings will start to take effect. And you can again check in the running system whether everything is the way you wanted it to look and if necessary, iterate on what exactly it's been doing. Now, if all else fails, for example, because you have a TianaCore EDK2 as a bootloader instead of U-boot, or because you have a very ancient U-boot that does not have those FTT commands enabled, as a last resort, pretty much, it is possible to specify a device tree with grub. There is a device tree command that can be used to specify such a DTB file. However, this is not an overlay file. So this is really the device tree that Linux will be using directly. So for one, the bootloader always has an opportunity to modify any device tree that it uses as an input. For example, it can use a random number generator in order to generate an offset to use for kernel address space layout randomization. If you provided a fixed DTB, then you are in control of what exactly the kernel will see and nothing else will change after that. So it becomes your responsibility to make sure that this DTB file is in a sane shape. Custom CFG is a very convenient way to have those additional grub commands be integrated into our regular SUSE boot flows in that you can just run the config and SUSE will take care, well, the YAS tools and grub tools will take care of generating a menu with the various kernel versions that you have installed. And for example, before or after that menu, it would just be executing any commands that you've specified this way. Obviously, one handy thing that I always do is also insert an echo to actually make sure that it is doing what I want when I want. Yes. And I've been talking about a lot what you do with the DTBO or DTB file. How do you actually get those files? For one, the Raspberry Pi comes with a number of pre-generated DTBO files for certain frequently used expansion boards. But it is also very easy to write this on your own with a simple text syntax. The main things that you will need to do for any given node, be it a spy node, I2C, UART, PWM, whatever it is, in the end is that you need to make sure that the specific function you want to use is actually enabled. You do that by overriding the status property. And in some cases, it may be necessary to assure that also the so-called pin control configuration is set. That means switching between whether the physical pin is actually going to be just an input-output or whether it has a special function like, for example, those mentioned here, spy, UART, whatever exactly. Once you have the driver enabled, the second task is to make a driver-specific node addition to there. So if you have a serial port, you can directly, via the serial device bus, attach drivers to interface with the UART. Or obviously, for spy nodes, you can have just regular spy drivers that are interfacing with the hardware registers and transfers directly. And again, it depends on the individual driver, what exactly needs to be specified there. Usually there is documentation for my new stuff, and that is something we're still working on, but usually examples are available that can be copied from. Now, to the actual project. At some point, you will have, on the one hand, your board running our Linux, and on the other hand, some random chipset. So for example, this is a clickboard that implements the LoRaWAN radio standard. And the question is, if you have the hardware and you have the board, you might have either a connector or there's various adapters available, for example, to go from Raspberry Pi 40 pin out to Arduino pin out, or this click pin out, microbus pin out, sorry, or XB, or any number of vendor-specific variants. And the big question is, how can you then make use of this hardware? This. Before I get to the details of that, I'll be talking a bit more about variants of the LoRa radio modules. So this one that I was just holding up over here is the middle variant, where you have a small microcontroller on board of the expansion board. This is then driving the actual radio communication, and you are communicating, in this case, via a UART. And it is up to that microcontroller firmware provided by the vendor to determine how exactly you speak to that particular module. The reason that many vendors do this is because it allows them to certify the firmware that they've developed, and afterwards you can use that in various regulatory regions of the world not have to deal with that yourself. Whereas like the original class of devices that I was starting with have the actual chipset directly on the board without any additional microcontroller. And that means that in many cases it's going to be the serial peripheral interface or UARTs. In some cases it might even be via a USB connection, be it be USB SPI or USB UART. For that, it will be exposing directly the full features of the physical layer of the radio communication. So that means you can send out various packets, but if you want to have a specific protocol like LoRaWAN, then you need to have a so-called software MAC, medium access control layer driver, that is implementing the actual packet frames and structure of that particular protocol that you want to drive and any addressing and related functionality. Finally, what you can see on the very right in gray is that there are also other modules that you will find that are outside of this category that we can use with Linux, in that they are actually meant to have the user install custom firmware on a microcontroller, and usually on those microcontrollers there is insufficient RAM to actually run Linux. Now, how to interface? This is trying to depict various subsystems of the Linux kernel. So like, you know, memory management, scheduling, and so on and so on. And then you have certain technology-specific subsystems, like, for example, SPI, TTY, and USB, where you have certain generic drivers that will allow you to expose a device to user space, allowing you from user space to then access via the standard syscalls and, well, glibc provided operations with those devices. In particular, what you will find a lot is like GitHub projects that will be using SpyDev in order to send and receive messages via the spy bus, as well as what most of you will probably know is if you have like a serial console or a, you know, other UART connected devices connected, you will have some form of TTY device that you can then access to via those commands and, you know, write from random user space programs. What I've been working on instead is to have drivers inside the Linux kernel that will abstract those vendor-specific interfaces. So just like you have an ETH0 device or whatever it may be obscured depending on the system configuration, you will have network interfaces that expose and that allow you to create a socket, which in turn will be using buffers to manage and move around packets, both outgoing and incoming. And provide a interface that is specific to this radio technology as opposed to one of those many particular chipsets for that technology. On the software side, those socket layers, then as the current state of discussion and implementation, would be using the PF packet protocol family down on the left side over here to send raw LoRa packets, which allows you to send data from one board to another board, you know, just send and receive arbitrary data in any way that you want to format it. And as an alternative besides that, there has been work ongoing on developing such a soft MAC for LoRaWAN as a module that would then be translating from a higher level packet family LoRaWAN with two different modes in that case, either directly to hardware-specific command interfaces like AT commands or other forms of communication, or to translate that to the existing LoRa driver stack on the lower layer. Similarly, just like you have the config 802.11 module for Wi-Fi, there is a config LoRa module in the works, which allows you to set certain configuration details by exposing a Netlink LoRa interface, such as, for example, setting the frequency, getting the frequency, setting the spreading factor, bandwidth, other aspects of the technology. This is being worked on at the moment. And the idea is to have the same thing also for LoRaWAN, so that on top you have an abstract layer that is modeling things like data rates and configurations on this higher level that will then translate directly to either the hardware MAC layer over here or to the existing NLoRa interface for the soft MAC chipsets. What can you do with that? Well, you can, as the user, directly use the LoRa interface to send whatever packages you want peer-to-peer. There's also some proprietary protocols that someone could theoretically implement, but that we cannot implement ourselves as a GPL implementation. LoRaWAN was already mentioned. On top of LoRaWAN, you can drive, again, all kinds of payloads yourself. But most of the LoRa chipsets also expose an FSK modulation. That's a different kind of transmitting the data. So basically, you have amplitude, frequency, and phase as the three axes that you can modulate data on, or combinations of them. LoRa chipsets by Semtech expose both as alternatively configured modes. There is a large range of protocols that are based on FSK, some in the home automation sector, for example. You can read some of those names here. I'm not going to go into all of them. BLE, depending on which frequency spectrum we're thinking on. So LoRa usually is being used in the sub-gigahertz spectrum, but FSK can also be used in the 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, for instance. That's where Bluetooth Low Energy is located. And there is actually some chipsets that have like three of those modes implemented in one module, as well as a number of not GPL, or at least either not documented or not legally implementable as GPL technologies that are listed here, as well as OOK is an amplitude-based, very simple modulation. And in the 2.4 gigahertz LoRa chipset, there's also what they call the fast long-range coding as an additional modulation technology. Netlink operations could use people that either propose interfaces or actually implement them. That is something that has been worked on in, well, a number of the last weeks since the NetDev conference. So for the generic interface, as well as one particular chipset, it usually takes one night to implement one or two of those operations just for one chipset, and there's many more that are in the work. So over time, we'll need to complete the existing driver implementations or add new implementations for whatever chipsets it is that you have access to. In order to make use of the drivers for various boards and combination of boards, adapters, expansion boards, and chipsets, one always needs those DT snippets. In theory, ACPI is another technology that could be used, but that currently is not implemented. Testing is always needed over time to catch errors. We have open design discussion on how to actually do things, where decisions need to be taken, and in some cases testing has resulted in entirely unrelated problems in the kernel that simply have become hurdles. Like, for example, that the clock driver interface simply locks up when called from certain operations on platforms, but not on all, so that it wasn't initially noticed. So increasing that base will certainly be a good thing. There is a new mailing list available for this, Linux LP1 on InfraDead. There is also a LoRa ISC channel available. And there are previous presentations of mine with more details on the technical implementation and any particular open issues. And feel free to catch me after this talk or later during the conference for more detailed discussions. Now, moving on to how this has actually been developed. In general, these are basically the choices that people have if you want to develop a new kernel driver. For one, you can always just get the original Linux Git checkout, compile it on an ARM board or cross-compile it on your Intel machine, deploy it some way by copying over the files to that system. The alternative is to take the kernel source Git repository that we are using to build the distro kernels. You could, in theory, throw a couple of patches into there and have them built by the OBS infrastructure. Then you have a package that you can just easily install. but you know, fiddling that in each time is going to be work that so far I have not engaged in. And then a third option that I've been using extensively is that in addition to the kernel default or kernel LPIE kernels that we are building for the distro, there are actually accompanying kernel default develop packages and a kernel develop package that includes all the intermediate binary files and headers needed for kernel development on that particular board with our kernel sources, and you can then use that to build modules locally on that system and simply insert them into the kernel. It will show a taint message, but well, what do we care? The alternative would be to put this into a spec file again, you know, package one big or multiple patches, apply them to sources, and then build a KMP package in OBS, and again, install such a KMP package in addition to the kernel package that you already have installed. In my case, I had a number of ARM, also MIPS boards, and other architectures around, and depending on the board, obviously, we don't have a MIPS distribution for OpenSUSE, so there I've been just cross-compiling an upstream kernel and testing that directly for the ARM boards, the approach that I was just mentioning. For that purpose, there is a GitHub repository of mine that has a makefile, and this makefile automates, if you just run make, reading out the current kernel version using that particular directory that we have in order to build the local tree of kernel modules against that. The current requirement is it needs to be a kernel 4.20 or newer, so it doesn't work with Leap, only with Release and Tumbleweed. And then, yes, there is a kernel org repository with some already posted patches staged for LoRa drivers as well as FSK. There's sometimes I'm ahead of myself and have a queue of new things in my private GitHub repository that I still need to send out. And all those boards then have basically the same drivers installed, and I can then use one of those boards in order to send via one of those interfaces and try to receive that data on the other boards. And currently that is being done by using debug output from the kernel on those boards since the receive path on most of the drivers is not yet fully implemented. So a number of people helped make this happen. Ben Witten from company Laird, they do gateways, has been contributing to the SX1301 Linux driver, as well as some volunteers in Taiwan, Chen Hong Pan, and in as well as several others in Germany, and a number of that was here the company I was just talking about, and a number of other vendors have helped us out in providing hardware to allow for a broader testing of those drivers and creating more drivers and finding an abstract interface that fits all those various vendor-specific interfaces. So thank you again to those people who have made that happen. And if you have hardware from companies that is not listed here, just let me know or talk to those companies whether they may be willing and interested to participate as well. Having talked a lot about ARM boards already, I'll be giving a couple updates as a bonus here. So for one, Thorsten Duwe has been working on the Olimex Terrace 1 notebook. That's a notebook kit that you assemble yourself based on the Allwinner A64 system on chip. He has been actively working on upstreaming U-boot support for this board so that we have the regular OpenSUSE Tumbleweed workflow working on that one. In addition, the, please, so this is Thorsten Duwe here. Can we have a round of applause for him, please? So, looks like a notebook, behaves like a notebook. This is it, and as you can see, it is running Linux.
I just updated the regular weight from 15.0 to 15.1. It's running a custom kernel, although I'm currently in the process of pushing the final patch series upstream, but otherwise it's an upstream 5.2 kernel and regular ARM64 OpenSUSE Leap 15.1 running there.
I would assume that in 15.1 probably the network drivers or something would be lacking. Oh, what do you need the custom kernel for?
It's only the EDP bridge for the internal display. I mean, if you read kernel, the kernel mailing list, it's that series that we're currently discussing, and that's the final thing for growth support. Bluetooth and HDMI have minor issues, otherwise it should be fully supported right now. Whichever. If people are, you can keep it there and people look at it afterwards. I don't care.
And if you're interested, find Thorsten after the talk. He may be able to share some experiences in case maybe you have a slightly different variant of a device that you would want to make OpenSUSE run on. We've been running the Pine 64 for quite a long time already. Now also the Banana Pi A64 has been getting some testing and packaging. Same chipset, that is, and then for the all-winner H6 SoC, the Pine H64 has started slowly to work. So since the 5.0 kernel, I think also the network on that one is working. However, I've noticed that despite having a Raspberry Pi compatible connector, there are some limitations compared to the Pine 64 in that not all pins can actually be used with the other connectors on the board at the same time, in particular UART and Ethernet, I'm aware of. Okay, NXP CoreIQ. There has been a Freedom LS1012A board with rather limited resources that we've been having difficulties actually getting OpenSUSE to run on. Then there was a new freeway board with some additional connectors and connection possibilities. For example, connector to connect this, in theory at least. Unfortunately, U-boot for that is not upstream, and I've not been able to modify the U-boot environment to actually circumvent that. So it really needs to me to stop the boot on the burst and manually type or paste in commands in order to boot into our kernel. But so far, it's been working. Unfortunately, the upstreaming of that was never completed by NXP, so the whole network complex is working, which impacts the use of the UART connections that are behind a spy bridge on that microbus connector. So unfortunately, again, it can be used for, maybe able to use for spy, but not for UART. Your mileage may vary, as they say. The new kid on the block is the NXP IMX 8M chipset. So two community-ish boards have surfaced for that. One is the PicoPi, the other one is the Coral board from Google. On those boards, NXP has been shipping a slightly outdated version of U-boot. It does already have the support for booting EFI. It's not being used via the distribute setup, unfortunately. So it is possible to manually interrupt the boot and run those commands. However, then Grub will not find its config because the U-boot still has some bugs because it's not current. Apparently no one has been working on those new boards yet to make sure that an upstream bootloader is available that would fix those particular problems. I had started the upstreaming for Action Semiconductor boards, in particular the Bubblegum 96 board, as well as a few others mentioned here. I've been getting some help, making progress with the drivers. Unfortunately, those activities have ceased for the moment. So we're still on an SD card driver that we could really load a rootFS from. There is a U-boot available, but beware that for one of those boards, but be aware that it does not have the full set of drivers, so it's not really that useful yet. But if you're interested in it, there is now a Linux Actions, a mailing list on Infradead that you can join if you are interested in those particular chipsets. Similar with Realtek, unfortunately there have been some problems with the interrupt controller for quite a long time, and time issues on my side, so there is not much progress on that. Some people have showed interest to help out with that topic, and there is a Linux Realtek SOC mailing list, also on InfraDead, that can be used to coordinate efforts between volunteers. NVIDIA has, with much fanfare, introduced a new Jetson board. Unfortunately, it is, fact is that it is using like an older generation of the Tegra chip, the X1. We had already successfully tested the trusted firmware and U-boot for that particular chipset, so hopefully that should be fine. If anyone has one and can provide feedback, that would be appreciated. Looking at certain people in the front here. And yeah, I've made the experience for the X1 generation. Things have been working okay with flashing things onto those boards for me, but since upgrading to Leap 15.0, I've been unable to actually get anything onto the X2 board. So that remains to be retested with 15.1. And similar story with Rockchip, so there are some new boards that have surfaced, and we've also prepared some packages for those. Unfortunately, I've not been able to test them, because similarly, the USB flashing tool for that one is broken in current 15.0 and needs to be tested whether anyone has come up with any fixes or workaround for that one. Finally, since I've spoken about ARM so much, not been able to speak much about other architectures, we've not been seeing much presentations here about RISC-V, so I've taken the opportunity to say a few words about that one as well. So for one, if you have QEMU packages installed on OpenSUSE on whatever system you have, you can emulate a RISC-V system. There are now U-boot packages available that can be used with that. U-boot packages are now also available for the currently single available hardware Linux-compatible board for RISC-V, the Hi-5 Unleashed. Unfortunately, either way, grub support for RISC-V is still missing, at least in our package, possibly also upstream. So some things still need to happen to have a easy user experience there, but it's already possible to use it. Andreas Schwab has been spending a lot of time working on this, and you probably already know that for the ARM architecture, you can find all the various packages in the OpenSUSE Factory ARM project, and similarly, there is an OpenSUSE Factory RISC-V project that is building for this new architecture. That is it. We do still have roughly 5 minutes for questions. Anything about LoRa or ARM boards and hardware attachment in general? Heiko, any updates that you may want to share for Rockchip? No. Yeah, in the back. Please go ahead.
Is it possible to swap, disable the Bluetooth on the Raspberry Pi 3 and use the hardware you are instead from an OpenSUSE image yet?
Not on the regular Raspberry Pi. So the pins of the what is being used for the Bluetooth UART are not being exposed on the board in any way that I know of being able to at least easily access them. So you have only one UART that is being exposed there, and via a DT overlay you can switch whether that is the TTY-S0 or the TTY-AMA0. If, however, you use the Raspberry Pi compute module with some baseboard that does not have Bluetooth chipsets on there, then you can actually use both. And we've been, Matthias over here has been working on a device tree overlay that can be used to enable that second UART, because apparently that is not being done by default. Yeah. Oh yes, so We've been working with a company called Embedded Microtechnology in the UK. They have a baseboard called MyPy that you can, you know, plug this DIMM-shaped compute module into and then have like pretty much the same or possibly even, well, about the same on even more connectors than you would have on the Raspberry Pi in a rather, well, larger shape. So that, and then also has their own expansion mechanism for having like industrial grade I/O with, you know, like higher voltage levels than you would usually have on the Pi. And yeah, that is one way to get around certain limitations of the Raspberry Pi, you know, 3 Model B, B plus boards. Any further questions? Okay, then, thank you very much for your interest. Oh yes, what I had been standing here on the board is two more things to show. So I was speaking about adapters from one type of expansion board to another. For example, this one is matching from the 96 boards where it was previously pretty difficult to attach anything because they have smaller pitch of only 2 millimeters instead of the 0.1 inch and 1.8 volt instead of 3.3 volt. So this goes from that particular output to Raspberry Pi and Arduino connectors. It's still slightly difficult since this is an early adapter to make use of it, so it needs some configuration on the system to choose how the pins are actually going to be routed. And since it has an FPGA on board, it costs about as much as the cheapest 96 board. Other adapters for going from Raspberry Pi to you know, the smaller microbus connectors, that's probably around, I don't know, 15, 20 euro. And yeah, depending on whether any additional chipsets are on such an adapter, you know, the price will vary and the size of it, of course. The other thing I brought here is something that I already showed at the OpenSUSE booth at FOSDEM. This is essentially a Raspberry Pi. I actually opened that last time and showed the inside since I exchanged the Raspberry Pi there to be 64-bit. You can see, you know, the connectors of that here on the outside that you may recognize. And on top of the Raspberry Pi, it then has like a custom designed adapter to go to a particular LoRa module there. And they've designed, you know, a aluminium case around that and are basically selling that as a product. And you will find that quite a lot if you look around, that people are actually taking the standard SBCs and then, you know, making some waterproof case that is much larger possibly than the actual board around that and selling that as, you know, gateway devices that are then put up on rooftops or somewhere on the wall.